Most gracious, most merciful, Master of the day of judgment, Thee do we worship, and Thine aid we seek. Show us the straight way, the way of those on whom Thou hast bestowed Thy grace, those whose portion is not wrath, and who go not astray. In that very first surah, the Al-Fatiha, or the opening, you can feel a little bit of the psychology which is common to many Muslims. You notice the emphasis on God as a cherisher and a sustainer. That's just two of the several ways in which, by custom, Muslims try to acknowledge the great power of God. There are 100 titles or 100 names, that's a schematic way of doing it, in which they try to address that major theological problem. What is it that human beings do when they try to talk about God? If, as we said yesterday, the Muslim, no less than the Christian, or at least some Christians, emphasize the transcendence, the otherness of God, that the persons are part of a wonderful creation, how, with all their reason, can they really talk about what is so different? So in the Western world, we have our theologies which rely so much on analogy. In Islamic thinking, one of the approaches is to rely on the different names of God. So here, at the beginning, the emphasis is on most merciful. But you notice, too, Master of the Day of Judgment. That's a major theme in Islamic teaching. It permeates all kinds of thinkings and all ways of approaching life. Again, the cultural differences among Muslims will reduce that. But one of the major reasons why we call Muhammad a prophet and a reformer was that he told the people of Mecca and Arabia that there was to be a day of judgment. He wasn't just criticizing their polytheism and their use of idols. He wasn't just criticizing their infanticide. He wasn't just criticizing the what we might call civil war or internecine fighting among the tribes. He was saying that unless you change at some future life, a life you don't recognize on this earth, there will be eternal damnation and punishment. So the notion of salvation from the fires of hell is an extremely important part of Islamic teaching. And when we contrast it in detail to Christian notions of hell, there's quite a bit of difference. Just as, for example, if we would contrast the notions of a heaven, particularly on the folk level, then to some degree it's true, our exaggerations that Muslims think, well, when we get to heaven, there's going to be lots of wine was prohibited on this earth. Well, we can drink some wine. There'll be flowing gardens. It's understandable in a desert environment where that would be important. And then to titillate ourselves that there are these dancing girls. See? And that aspect of heaven, satisfying sensual, if we use that word, just ordinary bodily needs or desires, has been overemphasized by Christian apologists to the point of saying that Islam is an excessively sensual religion. And that's fit in with the general Western notion about the Orient, that it is corrupt, in a basic way corrupt. That's true even when Christians talk about the Eastern churches historically, that there's something wrong with this life in the Orient. It's like the peach, you know, for a short time tasty, but immediately it ripens and gets rotten. And that might not be so clear to many of us today, but it's an important part of the Western Christian's perception of everything that is not a European and Western. So there's no way in which I can overemphasize for Muslims in general the importance of the notion of judgment. That's how many Muslims see the Ayatollah Khomeini today, that he is the instrument of God to chastise those Muslims who have gone astray. In general, all kinds of Muslims. Further, he's the instrument of God to chastise those Muslims who, from their point of view, don't belong to the right group. Khomeini is a Shia or Shiite Muslim. Some people liken this major division in Islam between the Sunni, the majority, and the Shi'i, the Sunni, to something like a Protestant and Catholic. Again, if you use it as an analytical device, it can get you somewhere. If you're just satisfied to say that it's like Protestant and Catholic, it's as misleading as to say the Quran is like the Bible. You maybe start out with that kind of parallel or analogy, but you can't be satisfied at all if you really want to penetrate the psychology, the ritual, the understanding of Muslims. So again, let me say that for many Muslims, Khomeini is the instrument of God. Now that's even a greater possibility in terms of the Shiite tradition, who in relationship to the Sunni, I could say, other people wouldn't like me to say it, there's a kind of centuries of paranoia that they are the minority body. They're sort of like the remnant Christians, like many Christians in some ways who find themselves a numerical minority. They're even more convinced that God is on their side, that the rest are somehow basically wrong, that you have to improve the rest, that you have to get them back on the straight path. So that's another element in the conventional and very useful ways of trying to start some understanding of Islam. That is to recognize that Muslims perceive of themselves as being on the straight path. That the path is straight in the sense that it's been clearly demarcated. It's not confused with theological obscurities. That's another thing that's quite different in terms of Islam as a universal culture and Christianity, that even though there have been important theologians, the people who and philosophers, the people who are really trained in the law don't like to see themselves as theologians in the Western sense, because there's too much speculation involved there. They certainly don't like to see themselves as philosophers, because that's insanely speculative. See, what's really important and true has been revealed in the Quran, and that's what you use as the basis for your understanding of all reality. Not these speculative sciences, a theology, or a philosophy. It's straight in the sense that it's clear. It is not conceived of straight in the sense that it's easy. That one has to strive in order to finally attain salvation.
Kirk?
Yes?
Again, the only way we can talk is in things that we know. Mm-hmm. Do they think that the Quran is kind of self-evident, that you don't need people to interpret or to get the nuances, or that it's poetic? Are they more literalists?
That's a good question. It's hard to answer that adequately. I'll repeat a little bit of what I said yesterday, because I see there are some people who weren't here yesterday. Particularly, again, if we try to see it in relationship to Christian notions of revelation, or how comparative religion as a skeptical discipline, if not a believing discipline. The Muslim orthodoxy says God spoke to Muhammad through the instrumentality of the angel Gabriel. This revelation given to Muhammad, he then orally transmitted. His hearers wrote it down, and that's what becomes the Quran. It's approximately a 20-year process of this ongoing revelation. Now, from the scholar's point of view, that explains why the Quran seems like such a mixed-up scripture compared to some others. But I guess when you start looking carefully at other scriptures and you realize the history of religions, almost all of them had some periods when, for want of a better word, scholars get together and put some order. I mean, the Buddhists had their various canonical conventions so they could distinguish among themselves and get things in order. So I guess maybe one thing we would say, that in all religions, even those religions that have revelation as an important category, on the one hand, God's quite plain, but on the other hand, it seems like you could have done it in an easier way. So you could have just sort of dropped it down, and that's the way it was. So what is in the Quran, from the point of view of a certain kind of a strict orthodoxy is a complete. It's complete in two senses, at least. It completes the revelation to the Jews and to the Christians. As I indicated yesterday, from the Muslim point of view, those are valid, legitimate, necessary revelations that the people of those books, the Old Testament and the New Testament, do have some beginning on this straight path. But their understanding of the path and the ways that they have been led by their leaders are significantly deficient. And that's why Muhammad has to bring the final revelation. From the Muslims' point of view, the Quran is the last revelation of a communal kind. Now here we get into some problems about if you pray privately or in the solitude, Allah can say something to you, but that's for you. And it won't change what is normative for the community. The second idea in this particular regard is that it tells you the basic principles for everything in life. So the notions which we have in the modern West, which when we think about it are relatively new notions even in the West, of separating and distinguishing between personal and private, between family and public, between church and state, are not acceptable. That if you hear expressions like the Muslim accepts a total ideology or a total religion, hear that. As I indicated yesterday, there's a debate going on among Muslims today where a kind of minority or reformist position is, well, even if the Quran is a basic revelation, if it is the last revelation, even if Muhammad is the seal, that is, that's the end, it's closed, you see, bam, you lick the letter and you put the seal on it, that's the end, there's no more going to be put into these letters from God. Even if those things are true, practically, there can be different kinds of political, governmental arrangements. There's no way of getting out of it. And so there has to be, at least from an analytical point of view, these more reformist Muslims would say, a distinction between private and public, and that the private in some way, similar to the Western notions of democratic societies and secular states, that there will be some freedom for people to live as they want under a secular government. So that's much disputed and discussed, even if the theory is accepted, how you put that into practice. I'm not getting quite to your answer, so John, ask me the question again so I can try to get, after I've given that sort of background, a little bit more specific to it.
Maybe a way to ask it is if you transferred our language over, would they be more fundamentalist or literalist than they would be form critics and literary?
All right, yes, they'd be very much fundamentalists.
Yes. Okay.
In terms of the history of the developing of the science of Islam among the Muslims, their self-image is that they have been very historical and very objective in the way they have put the Quran together, in the way in which they have collected the traditions about the life of the Prophet. It's a little bit like our notions of apostolic succession, that here nothing is accepted without recognition that somebody had said that and there was kind of objective evidence to say that this was true. So from their own point of view, they're extremely what today we call scientific and objective. But when it comes to applying the newer or the developments in form criticism, in archaeology, so archaeology would be very important in terms of the earliest periods of Islam, when Mohammed is transforming those tribes into a Muslim community. So archaeology, the various ancillary sciences we have for the study of the Bible, they're very leery of those. And part of the reason, I think, why they're very leery of them is a kind of mindset that all these things have basically been resolved in an earlier, more glorious period of our history. But it is the recognition that the development of these tools and instruments has come in the West by Christians, by Jews, and by people who are not believers in any of those religious faiths. They're just the secular scholar who's trying to find out something, and sometimes their image is that he's the debunker or he's the person who wants to undermine all religion. So I think that reinforces their reluctance to apply such instruments and tools to a historical, sociological analysis. Now, in the history of Islam, however, there are traditions which from some points of view are minor. That is this tradition of philosophy that I talked about. And a lot of the philosophers had a hard time because as philosophers, they often seem to be heretics in terms of the kinds of conclusions or questions they ask. The same with theologians, particularly if they moved in the direction of a speculative theology. But more importantly, I would say the Sufi. Maybe I should write that a little bit. Like a lot of things with Islam, we're not sure about some basic sort of things, like what does the word Sufi come from? Very commonly it's asserted that it comes from an Arabic word for wool. And the wool, because of the scratchy clothes that a hermit or a holy man or some person who wanted to give up the pleasures of the world would have against his skin. I think the great weight of scholarship uses that as the probable explanation for the origin of the word Sufi. But just the word Sufi suggests what can happen in Islam. There are others that come along and say, oh no, Suf is like the Arabic word that indicates pure. Now, from the point of view of etymology or linguistics, that may be a false etymology, but from the point of view of thinking and meditation, it could be a useful idea that the Sufi is the one who is concerned with the purity of himself. And the purity of himself means that he will ask difficult questions. He won't be able to take the Quran literally or as applied by the teachers. Now that gets a little bit closer to your question. In all religious systems, can't go into the sociology of it, but in all religious systems, after a while, there are people who presume or in some way recognize or accepted as having basic skill and talent for interpreting it. So what it says is in some ways dependent on the interpreters, the clergy, the ministers, the priests, the ulama, whatever. So they're the ones who historically have often said, yeah, this is really what it means, and this is how it should be applied in life. The Sufi often is the person who says, those guys are weighting us down with legalism. Now, they may be motivated by high ideals or by tradition, but remember that God isn't just the God who gives laws. God is the creator of all the things that are good. We can't be bound down in our effort to have union or communion with God by these external rules. So the Sufis often are, like some of the philosophers, they get zapped. Particularly if in their ecstasy they say things kind of heretical, like Al-Hallaj, who was crucified. You might even see the significance of that. His Sufism, his ability to have personal communion with God and ecstasy was so extreme that he says something like, well, I've been looking for God, I finally found God, it's me. Now, that's the way we translate it. Actually, the Arabic uses haq, the idea of truth. That I've penetrated what is most important, and I now see the truth, and it's very, very mystical. Second thing, since it comes up about the Sufis very often are very important political figures. They don't tend They don't intend to be political. But since they are often motivated by some vision of God, and they're very often motivated by the notion of God's justice, they often have been people who espouse gentle justice, and sometimes they espouse justice not so gently. They're the leaders of jihad, or holy war, in the physical sense of using a sword, or, in some cases, they're really ideal passive resistors. They go before the sultan, they go before the public leader, and they criticize him. So in the history of Sufism, or these mystical teachers, you find many of them end up in jail. They are, in a sense, the spokesman for the people. They are the spokesman for justice in contrast to legalism. They stand for a more immediate experience of God, which is not necessarily one mediated by the teachers or by the religious leaders. I don't know if that helps at all, John. Yes?
Would you speculate on what the message was that Father Jenko brought from his captors?
I've wondered about that. I certainly wouldn't speculate out loud because I don't really have enough of an idea of what message was given to him. If a message was given to him, this is not speculating, I suppose, but if a message was given to him, it wasn't given to him by any representative of world Islam, because there is no such figure. There is no Pope, there's no Archbishop of Westminster or anything like that. There's no longer even a Sultan Caliphate at the top of the Ottoman Empire. It could, however, be an important message from some significant group, or it could actually be a very important message from a group which, from a number of points of view, is extremely insignificant. The importance of the message may have nothing to do with who said it. And in fact, there may be no message in the conventional sense. I really wonder. When I was home, I tried to follow it pretty carefully, but I have no idea what that message is. As you probably realized, there's been some notice in the newspapers that there really was no message. So I really don't have any idea what was in the message. Somebody else, I think, had a question over here.
Well, I did before. It was different. I was just wondering, in the Quran, are there different versions, you know, like a King James just itself, or are there in different areas?
Well, there certainly are a number of translations of the Quran, but no translation from the Muslim point of view is ever adequate to the message of the Quran. Now, this reflects what from some points of view might be seen as a cultural bias of the Arabs and the Arabic language using people. But there is some reinforcement from the point of view of people who are not Muslims and who are linguistic scholars. And that is that part of the genius of Arabic as a language is that certain things can be expressed very well in Arabic. But when you translate them, or you try to translate them from Arabic — John had a short lesson last night in Greek and Hebrew — it often is not so, it's not the easy. In fact, it's quite the difficult. So there are a number of translations of the Quran. I was going to fit this in at a later point when I talked about the universalism of Islam, and how England has, since the 19th century, in some ways been an important source for the spread of Islam in Europe and throughout the world. First with a mosque at a place called Woking, W-O-K-I-N-G. That starts early in the century. And the Muslims who established that mosque were, from the point of view of the Sunni, heterodox. They came from India, and they were in the tradition of the minority Muslim groups, but they nonetheless were very important for establishing the mosques, starting publications, and spreading the word of Islam. Today in England, Leicester is probably the major cultural ideological center for religious Islam in England. There are several important centers of scholarship, like the University of Glasgow, where Montgomery Watt and a long tradition of the study of Islam exists. Often people who had been missionaries or intended to be missionaries, preparation for missionary. And then, of course, in England proper, at the London School and a number of other schools. But one of the first translators into English of the Bible was a convert to Islam, an Englishman, Marmaduke Pickthall. Now, the name's wonderful, you know, I think. You can hardly forget the name. See, you might not remember anything from the lecture, but Marmaduke Pickthall is a name that tends to stick in your mind. So that's one translation. It's available in paperback, a New American Library. His translation's been available for a long, long time. In the Penguin edition, there's a translation by a Muslim whose background would be more Indian, or what we might call the Western Bombay-type Indian Muslim. Then there are important annotated translations by Arbery and Nicholson in English. There are a variety of translations, but with the exception of Pickthall, Muslims very often feel that a translation by a Muslim is a better translation.
That wasn't my question. Hmm. My question is, in the Quran, in the Arabic, are there different versions coming from different strains?
No.
They don't have the original.
I'm not sure what you mean by the original.
Well, the original Quran, which came down from...
No, it wasn't. What we want to emphasize is that it is a word, that God's message was spoken to Muhammad through the angel, so he heard it. That's not just in Islam, but in Hinduism, an important notion about revelation, that there are truths that are heard, that they come in through this particular sense. It's heard. Now, you see, again, go back to these earlier periods of human experience where writing was not that common or that well known. That the lore and the science of a society often had to be oral. You could have symbols for certain kinds of things, but you didn't have a written language in the way we have it today.
See, I'm trying to equate it with the Christian tradition, the oral tradition, and then the various versions like the Vulgate and so forth like that.
There is nothing like that. There are sort of layers of revelation and lost texts which could be talked about, but that would be one parallel, or I'd say, don't see the parallel. Because the Vulgate, again, is not something that represents the language of the apostles. So what? I'm not sure what would be the analog in Arabic. There are different remnants, so to speak, of what could have been earlier forms. When the Quran came out in its first printed edition, I forget which caliph it was, but again, it's after the first. For successors. So again, you have this kind of break in terms of the apostolic period of Christianity. When that was printed, he sent a copy to all the major cities, and there was great celebration. See, before that time, it had been transferred to one another orally until it took that written form. So undoubtedly, there are various written parts of it before you get this final form. But I don't know that we get too far by trying to see too close a parallel to the different forms of the Christian Bible. Any other?
Yeah. What was the time frame of Muhammad?
His life is from 570 to 632. I'm not sure in terms of how we're progressing today whether I will be able to do the things in the order in which I thought. But since you raise his dates, you can see that's into the 7th century. In 622 occurs what's called the Hijra, or the fleeing from Mecca, the holy city of the Muslims. I think I need some other kind of writing tool.
That put the cap on every time Mercury dries up.
Yeah, I should know that. No, I'm sorry. Okay.
Maybe a little better.
No, I think that was dry, so that wouldn't be dry yesterday. Mecca.
It reverses automatically. Yeah.
Mecca is this city in what today is Saudi Arabia. It's the place where Muhammad was born. He was orphaned at a very early age and raised by uncle and other member of the family. And he then became a caravan leader or camel driver. Eventually he married his Abbas, who was a successful woman entrepreneur, some years older than he was. And one way of interpreting is that after he's married and successful and recognized as an honest, good businessman, then he has time for revelation. He also has the experience of having traveled to Syria and other places, and he's heard what Jews and Christians and others besides the, quote, pagan Arabs had said. So he starts teaching what he has heard from God, and I already indicate that it includes these ideas of stop worshiping all these idols, that there's only one God. That you should stop fighting among yourselves, you should stop killing the children, particularly the girls. He argued for some changes in the marital relationships. And what you have to see is that Mecca was already a center of pilgrimage. The Kaaba, where the Muslim goes, this shrine where there's the black stone, that was already there. Being used for pagan worship. So just imagine some Hargis maybe or somebody, I don't know, coming to your town and saying, you guys have got it all wrong. I don't want any more pilgrimage here. Or say maybe the Pope goes to Lourdes and says, it's all wrong. There wasn't any apparition here. You got it all wrong. We can't have any more pilgrimage. Now, it's going to be hard to accept in terms of the religion, but in terms of the bucks, it's going to be really hard. No more pilgrims, no more money, no more jobs. They're going to understand why they say, you know, this guy's insane. We got to get rid of him. He not only is saying how we've been living's all wrong, but he's trying to tell us that we got to make a buck a different way. So he eventually is forced to leave. There were threats against his life. When he leaves in 622, he goes to what today we call a Medina, or Yathrib. So that becomes then the second very important city in the growth of Islam as a religion, and in the development of Muhammad as a prophet and eventually as a statesman, because when he gets to Medina, they accept him. He helps resolve certain kind of quarrels or difficulty in that city. But 622 then becomes the first date in the Muslim calendar. So it's a useful date to remember for a number of reasons, that the Muslim calendar, the lunar calendar that the Muslims use, start with his being forced to leave, an exile, political refugee, political religious refugee, you see, from Mecca going to Medina. Then he's in Medina for some number of years, where he's more successful in his teaching and preaching, and he goes back and he enters Mecca as the successful warrior. He's accomplished the jihad in that physical sense against the Meccans. And after he's in Mecca, he becomes not just the religious leader, but he becomes the political leader. And it's at that formative stage, you see, of Islam, where religion and society, where government and piety come together. So there is this notion right from the start that the leader may be a leader both in a religious sense and in the political sense. So that's his dates and the important dates at the beginning of Islam. Within a century, Islam has pretty well spread throughout all the Arabic-speaking areas, is beginning to move into the Byzantine world. In a couple centuries, it will occupy the European side of the Mediterranean. I brought a very convenient atlas of medieval history, so you can just sort of flip through the maps, and unless you've been teaching recently yourself, this is really a good book. It's really a good book, because although it says medieval history, it's medieval history from the point of view of today's world international history in contrast to the older notions of Western civilization. So you can see that the just by sort of looking at this, what's very important, yesterday, if questions hadn't gone the way they had, I would have talked about medieval world, particularly the intellectual world in the southern part of Europe, Spain to some degree and Sicily, was a tripartite culture, philosophically and theologically. Jews, Muslims, Christians discussing, arguing with one another. The Muslims being very important in reviving the Greek notions and the Greek philosophy, the Greek science, the Greek medicine. The Muslims, the Arab using Muslims, and here again, a lot of the books mislead you. See, they talk about that Arab philosopher so-and-so, Arab philosopher so-and-so, who wasn't an Arab at all. He would come from someplace like what today is Bokhara or Tashkent in the Soviet Union, but he used the Arabic language. So only in one sense is he an Arab philosopher, you see, in terms of ethnic origin, in terms of a kind of local orientation. He's not an Arab, but it shows how important the Arabic language is in terms of forming a world community and the basic theological, philosophical, and legal underpinnings for this religion or culture, which is worldwide. So I'll pass this around, and you can just sort of flip to those maps and see how quickly it spread.
When did he finally go to Jerusalem?
I'm not sure I know what you mean, when he finally went to Jerusalem.
At the mosque in Jerusalem, they tell you that this is where Mohammed ascended into heaven.
Well, I don't know. I guess I'd have to say it was sometime around 632, if he in fact did ascend into heaven.
On a white horse yet.
Well, see, now here we come to a very interesting thing about Islam. The Quran doesn't tell us that about Muhammad.
Oh.
Those are just traditions, stories about Muhammad. I would suppose that the great bulk of Muslims will believe those stories. But the philosophers often didn't believe those stories. Certain reformers don't believe those such stories. Then you have the question of, well, since it's such an important part of the tradition, do we just say that it's all wrong, or do we use it in some allegorical way? Of course, the more fundamentalists say you got to be literal. The others, and again, it's not new. See, these eruptions of less literalism have existed in the history of Islam for many, many centuries. And in some ways, they're the product of the culture that's different from the Arabic culture. And in some ways, it's partly a product of interaction with the Western world, particularly as we get into the 18th century. So let's see, how much Oh, we how much, I forget how much time we have now.
The bell will ring at 10 of, well, at 11:50.
Well, we still have a good amount of time then, don't we? Huh? I think my wife's watch conked out on me. What is the time
11:25
now?
11:25
now. 11:25. Okay. Well, I certainly have gotten off track in terms of what I had originally tried to say, but let me try to get through some of these fundamentals that would be shared by Muslims throughout the world, and then go to what's supposedly the more specific topic today, Muslim of various colors, I heard this morning at breakfast, and that's fine.
Could I ask, now when you use the word Muslim, I mean, I could be a Muslim. I mean, I don't have to be Arabic. I mean, does that mean that I'm a follower of Islam? Or that, when we used to use the word Mohammedan, I mean, what's that distinction? Or follower of Islam?
Okay, I'll some of you heard this yesterday, and maybe I didn't make it even clear enough yesterday. The word Islam is our way of pronouncing what in Arabic is a basic notion of a person surrendering to the will of God. So Islam is to surrender, to bow yourself to the will of God. Muslim is a word, is the noun form of that verb in Arabic. So Muslim is the person who in fact accepts Allah as the only God. Again, remember what we said, that these Arab tribes in which Muhammad grew up were polytheists. They had many gods. They had a god for each day. That's part of the lore of what he had to do. He had to convince them that there wasn't a god or a genie, as we sometimes say, like the genie in the bottle, a spirit. He had to convince them that all that was not true and correct. So anyone who accepts God can be called a Muslim. Particularly, now here we get into the more difficult part. The Muslim, strict Muslim notion is, and that Muhammad is his prophet. Sufis often don't deny that second part. But what they often say is before Muhammad came, there were Muslims. Because before Muhammad came, there were people. People who accepted the correct God. Sometimes they were Jews, sometimes they were Christians, and sometimes they were people we don't know. So today, for example, there's some interest in Sufism and Sufi dancing. And people like Pir of Vilayat Khan, out on the West Coast, Episcopal Church in New York, I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but a major Episcopal Church in New York has Sufi dancing. A couple churches in Evanston, various denominations have had Sufi dancing. Now some of these Sufi masters in the modern period really like to emphasize that. They say that anybody can be a Muslim even if he doesn't become a part of some Islamic community or group, because he accepts that there is only one God, Allah. In Arabic, Allah. Let me repeat again, I can't say it often enough in terms of today's international politics, that the Christian who happens to be an Arab, the Syrian Christian who happens to use Arabic, uses Allah as his word for God. That may seem like a little thing, but the symbolic reverberations are quite significant. If you focus on that one little thing, then it helps maybe in what we'll talk about in a later session when we focus on the Middle East and the problem of Palestine, Palestinians. That it's a little bit beside the point, but among the terrorists who have been Arabs, there have been Christians. You might say they're not good Christians because they engage in terrorism, but we can all say, with Gandhi again, you know, you Christians haven't been very quick to put the sword in the scabbard. So a Muslim is a person, from one point of view, in a loose sense, who will accept that there is one God. From the Islamic Muslim point of view, it's the person who accepts the one God and Muhammad as his prophet. Then by extension, he's the person who expresses his belief in God because he understands the Quran and he does what the rest of the community normatively ask him to do. So that may be the next thing that we should point to. There is the basic submission, the prayer which says, there is but one God, I accept him, I accept Muhammad as his prophet. Then secondly, there is the prayer that you perform personally, 5 times a day. Remember I said that Islam is the straight path in the sense that it's not too confused with a lot of doctrinal problems. The basic thing is quite simple, isn't it? Huh? Submit to God. Accept God as the creator, that you're the creature. But how do you do that then? You do things both personally and communally. And Islam really emphasizes the communal dimension. Now that's in part explainable sociologically by the kinship system of the Arabs, etc. But there are other things that could be brought up. So you have prayer when you submit to God. That's the initial prayer. I accept you, God. I'm your creature. The second one is to pray 5 times a day, and to pray facing the east, and to pray with the movement of the body. Again, a way of symbolizing the submission, with your head touching the ground, with your body being prostrate. Now, some people make fun of it as sort of the aerobic religion. That's fine, if you know what's, but you have to understand the symbolism. In terms of the teaching of the Muslim comes to appreciate the fact that wherever these Muslims are, in the United States, in Algeria, in the Soviet Union, even in China, in the Philippines, some of them in Australia, wherever they are, when they're praying, they're facing Mecca. If not all of them, at least a large number of them are praying through these bodily prostrations. So 5 times a day they do that. Then on Friday, it's the implication sociologically as a community that people do these things and we associate it with being a Muslim. So again, in a limited sense, you could be a Muslim just by believing God. I'll come to an important aspect of that both theologically and politically a little bit later. But to go on with the prayer, then on Friday you go to the mosque. And the mosque is a structure built particularly for communal prayer. Rows of men doing the same thing. In the back, the women. They can be doing the same thing, but not mixed in with the men. Before you pray, you wash yourself. A ritual washing, even to clean your mouth. A person leads you. The imam leads you. And often we'll start off with that prayer that I started off with today. Pretty standard. We'll start off with that. And then there is variation in terms of selections from the Quran, often a preachment called a khutbah. So there is a preaching stand in the mosque. There's a place for the Quran. And there is this part of the mosque which always indicates the direction to Mecca. So again, you have all these people doing things in unity, and there are some very exciting writings by Muslims and non-Muslims who are sort of overwhelmed by this mass psychology. And Muslims often are taught to feel this about themselves, that we are not just individuals, but we are this community, praying together throughout the world, 5 times a day. Accepting the same God. That's important in terms of its political implications. I think sometimes it can be overemphasized and can be seen as frightening, but it nonetheless is a basic reality. And the third thing is to fast. It's enjoined on the Muslim to fast during the month of Ramadan. the fasting period. So you fast when the sun comes up in the morning to the time that the sun goes down for approximately a month. But from the Muslims' point of view, they say, isn't this better than some of the Christian notions of fasting? Because we're kind of reasonable about it. See? When this sun goes down, then you can eat again. See? They like to compare themselves to certain strains of Catholicism particularly, where they say there is the over-aesthetic approach, that you try to force the aesthetic possibilities on everybody, where in Islam, if that's what someone wants to do to perfect himself, he's free to do it, but as a community, we all don't have to do it. But during this month of Ramadan, we do fast. Now, notice that 1, 2, and 3, while personal and communal, don't exactly have a political or economic dimension. But when we come to zakat, then we have something which is not just communal in the sense of prayer, but it's economic and welfare. It's a part of the Muslims' notions of justice and equality. Now, what I haven't stressed is when you pray and you fast, it's supposed to indicate that whatever the usual differences in the world of politics, education, are lost. Because when you pray, you all pray the same way. When you pray, you'll all be using Arabic. Even if you don't understand it, you've been taught the Arabic at least enough to pray. Then zakat is the technical term for what we might call tithing. The Muslim has two forms of almsgiving. The one which is absolutely required of everyone, the zakat, and usually that's given into what's called a religious foundation or a pious foundation. Today would be something like Red Cross or maybe some more local group which provides food, clothing, shelter. And then there is the idea that in addition to what's expected, the stated amount that's expected, people should constantly give gifts to those who need help, either money gifts or their personal help. And then fifth, see, that reinforces the notion of community again. You have responsibility that for the community to really be alive, there has to be some equality, some justice on the material level. And the fifth thing is the Hajj, or the pilgrimage. Now the Hajj, in some ways, is relatable to Muhammad fleeing and coming back then to Mecca. H-A-J-J, we usually translate as a pilgrimage. So the person who makes pilgrimage to Mecca is often referred to as a Haji. H-A-J-J-I or H-D-J-J-I, however you want to spell it, or just sometimes H-A-J-I. Haji. Now this is an interesting thing too in terms of Islam as a total system. Everyone is expected to attempt, honestly, to attempt to make Hajj or pilgrimage once during his lifetime, assuming that he is physically able and has the money to do that. Now, some people make Hajj many times during their lifetime. Some people never get there. They don't have the money. They're not really free to do it. That kind of latitudinarianism exists. It's sort of left up to your conscience as to whether you will go. But what we know is very often a community, a village, a city, or a section of a town, or the people associated with a given mosque, they want somebody from their group to make pilgrimage. We do something like that today. Don't we want somebody from our congregation to go to the women's meeting in Nairobi? Don't we want somebody to go to South Africa to represent our parish? So often they want someone to go on pilgrimage, so they collect the funds collectively and send that person. Now, often it will be a more aged person who showed some piousness or some wisdom. It's a little bit like one of our sessions today. maybe Mr. Olson can say something about it. It's this period in a person's life when wisdom sort of gets intermixed with senility. And so this person is sent, and again, think of past ages where it wasn't easy to get there. You couldn't hop on a jet. So you had to take a caravan, get on a boat, there was all kinds of things. So people would come back with great adventure stories about how it was going to make a pilgrimage at Mecca and coming back. So the word haji can be used in some situations to indicate piousness, seriousness, really having made pilgrimage. In other cases, it indicates the great storyteller, the guy who exaggerates, sort of a comical figure, often because he was kind of old. And there are all kinds of stories like, well, we can't just send one person, we'll have to send two to verify the stories, to make sure that before they get to Mecca, he doesn't fall into the flesh pots or whatever it happens to be. Another thing like that is this word mullah. When the Ayatollah was taking over, Khomeini was taking over in Iran, the newspapers like to use the word mullah, mad mullah. Well, they were echoing expressions that had been used in the 19th and the 20th century when there were a variety of mad mullahs that grew up either in the British Empire or in the French Empire. And mullah is another form of the word ulama, or mulana, a person learned in Islamic lore, a teacher. But often the teacher in these Muslim contexts was a little bit like the teachers in some of our frontier towns. He wasn't just the teacher in the school, he had a special role. Or sometimes like a pastor in the community. He isn't just the pastor, he has a public function outside of the church. So a mullah too is on one hand a person that's viewed with great seriousness, but often it's a way of saying a guy who's a little dippy. So again, you really have to be careful about the context in which you interpret or use various terms that Muslims have for themselves. So this would, I think now, at least in a short way, run through what's called the five pillars, or the basic normative expectations of Muslims. And the other thing, I guess, before we go on, to try to cover Islam throughout the world.
Herman?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Is that a good representation of...
I must admit that I never read the Hajj. I'm so prejudiced against Leon Uris that I've never read it.
I would
say that he is an insensitive racist. Well, let's see, I brought it with me. There are lots of... I thought about how much time I should devote, or rather should try to run off something in terms of readings. Before I go to this book, in our bookstore, I noticed they have Naipaul's book, Traveling Among the Believers. Naipaul is one of a team of brothers, one of them is now dead, whose place of origin, in terms of their family, is India, but he grew up in the Caribbean. So you can see him as an Indian writer, or a deracinated Indian, or a Caribbean. Many people who are sympathetic toward the problems of the third world, not exclusively Muslims, don't like him. They think that he's a kind of a racist, or an arrogant, westernized demi-Hindu or something. But I think the book is very good. I would recommend that book to anybody who wants to get some idea of the conflict in a large range of the Islamic world. And I think to some degree it's kind of stereotypical. Indeed, he does bring some of his prejudices, but it's a book very well worth your time. And I'd say it's like a lot of books on Islam. Maybe it's like a lot of books on all kinds of things today. You read it, you think about what you read, and you always got that salt being shaking over those pages. You know, you ask yourself, does this make sense? How can I find out more about it? Where do I go? Just like your response to yours. So I'd recommend that book. This is a book that I brought with me because I thought it was maybe useful to bring to your attention, because it shows how I've changed my mind about how I try to talk about Islam or explain Islam to other people. I guess I should say a little bit about it. I'm not a minister. I'm not a professor of philosophy. I'm primarily a professor of political science. That's my sort of professional identity. My vocational identity is something different, I guess, but professional identity is as a political scientist. So this is not normally what I do to make a living. This is part of what's become very important to me in terms of adequately teaching politics. It's what's become important to me in terms of trying to be on the right side of a justice in the Middle East. It actually, biographically, it comes because I was interested in Gandhi, and studying Gandhi, then I got interested in the first Gandhian All India non-cooperation effort, which involved the Muslims, the Khilafat agitation or the Khalifa agitation. So the background to this is not what some of you might suspect. I'm not. No one would ever call me, an Islamicist or Arabist or something like that. But occasionally, I do have to try to explain things to students, or just try to understand things myself.